Basically, we have three things that are four to do tonight. So the fourth thing is, there's one source we didn't cover last time in our kind of like Talmudic lexicon of various building blocks, which we need to do just at the beginning to kind of fill out our picture for some of the texts that are going to be reached for. And then I want tonight to take us through a series of texts where you'll see an effort to actually turn some of these different pieces into schemes of practice, thinking about how to navigate questions of trust, relationship, partnership, reliance around people that you have partial lack of trust with, disagreement, sense of gap around how you practice. And I'm going to look at it tonight through three subsections that are going to give us three windows, I would say, of how to tackle this. The first is going to be thinking about whether we should or it's possible or on what basis to construct kind of hierarchies of whether certain gaps that we have between us and other people imply and should imply other more comprehensive gaps. We saw that a little in the Talmudic piece last time that imagined, starting with the Mishnah, does my not trusting someone in one area imply an automatic presumption that they don't share my perspective on another area? To the extent it does, why and in what context? To the extent it doesn't, what's the basis for the firewall between those two components? The second piece we're going to look at is what I've called here the gift economy, and what we looked at very briefly in the topics, the sources that talked about Surya last time, these shopkeepers who are selling things that are different from what they're eating, that are different from what they're sharing with other people, and trying to understand how people behave differently in different kinds of interactions, even potentially with the same exact person. Why you might behave differently with someone who walks into your store as opposed to someone who is a guest in your home, and how that should impact the guest or the customer thinking about your behavior and their relationship with you. And then the third piece, which I alluded to last time, is we're going to go into two fascinating complementary tshuvot, response of Rav Moshe Feinstein, pushing the limits on the question of how much can my knowledge or my relationship with someone else kind of trump everything else about their patterns of religious observance behavior, my disagreements with them, because the personal relationship I have with them is so solid that ultimately everything goes into that container, and whether that can be a basis for thinking about building connection. That will all become clear as we go through this. But I want to kind of state from the outset what we got to at the end of last time, but tonight is really going to be the kind of theme and frame I want to put on this. We're going to be looking at a lot of details, a lot of cases, building off the sources that we've seen. But the thing that I want to come back to, focusing again and again, is what does this tell us about the role of the underlying relationships in forging the terms of discourse and debate and boundary that we see around these technical issues? Part of what I want to claim, and I'm going to say it at the outset but come back to, is on some level, that is kind of the whole ballgame. At the whole ballgame of whether you can work with someone, whether you can bridge various divides, actually depends deeply, if not almost exclusively, on how important it is to each of you to basically take the other's concerns in mind, and to act really with that kind of like vicarious responsibility for another person. The more you have that, the more a lot of the boundaries find a way of melting away, and the less you have that, the walls are going to go higher and higher. But we have to look a little and see how we play this out. Okay, so let's begin. Welcome for those who are coming in. Source sheets are here in the center. And grab a seat up here in front. I don't mind people sitting right next to me. That's great. So we're going to fill in that source from last time that we didn't get to. This is on the first page here, a Talmud Bavli in Chulin. For those coming in, the source sheets are right here on the central desk. Please come and take a copy. So I'll take us through this first source, and then I'm going to ask folks to read as we move forward. Okay, we start with a statement of Rava. about a Yisrael mumar ochel nevelot leteavon. This is a person who, the term mumar, as we'll see, is a very plastic term. It literally means someone who has switched over. It sometimes, in certain contexts, can mean like an apostate, someone who like just left Jewish practice entirely. But it can often mean someone who has just abandoned a certain aspect of Jewish practice or observance, and it can be very local. In this case, it's that sort of usage of the term. This is a Jew who eats non-kosher meat. That's part of their practice. We're given an important rider here. They eat it l'te'avon. In contrast to the other option that's usually paired with te'avon, l'ach'is. L'ach'is meaning they do it to make a point. They do it, right? The English translation of l'ach'is is l'ach'is, which is, right? It's to make someone else angry. It's davka, it's specifically to make a religious point. Someone who does something like te'avon is just, I wanted to eat that. I'm not making some big point. I don't observe a boundary around this, and this is fine. Rava says such a person who eats non-kosher meat, but just because they like to eat different things in the world, they're actually allowed to slaughter meat for you. You can rely on the validity of their shchita, provided you first check the knife to make sure it has no nicks and it's a perfectly valid knife. You don't rely on them to make sure all the equipment is fine, but if the equipment is all fine and you're just asking them, will you do this in the appropriate way, you can trust them and you can then eat that meat. And the reason given by Rava, which we saw in a different source that we'll come back to later about the shopkeepers in Syria, is since there is permitted and forbidden available, this person who doesn't have like a religious point to make, they're not going to abandon the permitted path for the forbidden path. Meaning, the person just likes to eat non-kosher meat when it's available. They're not invested in screwing up the act of slaughter when you hand them the knife and say, can you please do this in the way we all know you're supposed to do it. In that situation, they're perfectly happy to follow the rules. Okay, so that's Rava's statement. The fact that this person is deviant from your perspective in terms of their meat-eating practice doesn't totally disqualify them from slaughtering as long as you've set up the conditions appropriately. Okay, now, the text now goes on, and here you can, in the English, jumping down to the paragraph that has the bold in the middle, the Talmud says, actually, we feel like Rava has support from the following text. And here we have a statement that anyone can slaughter, anyone's valid to slaughter, even a Samaritan, a Kuti, you remember them from last time, even an uncircumcised Jew, afilu arel, va'afilu Yisrael mumar, and even a Jew of deviant practice. And now the Gemara is going to ask a question. We're not going to go all the way to the end of this passage, but it's going to ask a question which sets up an important ground fact for the medieval authorities. They want to know, what do we mean when we say, afilu arel, even an uncircumcised male Jew is allowed to slaughter? What are we talking about, says the Gemara? If it's a man whose brothers died because they were circumcised, meaning, why is he uncircumcised? Under Jewish law, if, God forbid, you have a family where you circumcise a child, and the child dies, that is then presumed to maybe be a freak occurrence. No one necessarily imagines that it's connected to that. But if they, God forbid, have a second child who then dies from circumcision after being circumcised, then any subsequent male children are not supposed to be circumcised. It's already a presumption that there's a danger there, and that just simply shouldn't happen. The Talmud says it can't be that we're including such a person as if they're a marginal character. They weren't even supposed to be circumcised. As it says here, Yisrael ma'al Yahu. There's no pockmark at all on that person's Jewish status or identity or their observance in any way. So the only thing it would make sense to include is a person who specifically decided, or their parents decided, and they never fixed it, decided not to be circumcised. That is to say, mumar la'arelut, someone who has abandoned, essentially rejected, the Jewish practice of circumcision, and nonetheless, is valid to slaughter. Okay, now, here's why this is important. Talmud then goes on to try to weave this in to how it might support Rava, which we're not going to spend time on. But the bottom line is what this text seems to suggest is a person could totally reject circumcision and yet be trusted with respect to ritual slaughter and not to trafe up meat. Okay, what, if anything, is surprising about that? You can answer that in general. You can answer it in light of some things we saw last time.
I mean, the thing that's confusing to me is actually attributing, value judgments about his Jewish practice with circumcision as something that happens to him.
Right. So you have to assume here that the onus is also on him, right, when he grows up to fix that. And by refusing to do that, as maybe unfortunate it is that his parents didn't take care of that beforehand, it doesn't make it any less. Now, I agree, we could have a whole thing where we could identify with, oh my God, but that's so scary, and there's no general anesthetic, and all sorts of things. But the assumption here, which we could interrogate in another context, is, okay, yeah, that's tough, but that's something you need to do. I think the other way we could possibly soften that is the Gemara might have a, might also be imagining someone who has done this out of an even more spiteful place than just being afraid. But remember, it doesn't even need to go there because this is fundamentally an inclusive text.
So they couldn't have been avoiding circumcision actively as an...
No, that's right. That's correct. But the idea seems to be even someone would stand up and tell you, my parents didn't do this to me, and thank God, this is totally barbaric. I completely reject this and find it horrible. Uh-huh. Even that person is valid to slaughter meat. Uh-huh. That's a claim of the Talmud. Yeah.
Maybe it's a little bit specific, but I kind of thought that in order to be assured that you have to be a certain kind of person, like you can't be a woman. I don't know if that's called
gender. So on the gender front, actually, seems you there is no gender requirement for being a shochet in terms of the actual slaughtering. There is later discussion as to whether being a shochet as an appointed role in the community is something that, in the context of gender politics that assume that men, women shouldn't have certain kinds of authority roles over men, that's the whole discourse around srara in rabbinic literature, maybe the shochet is like being, God forbid, a rabbi. But, you know, but right, on the actual kind of core requirements of what's required, Talmud's actually pretty clear that women are allowed to do that. But that's another story. But what's, if anything, surprising about having someone who's a mumar la relut being allowed to slaughter? Yeah.
You're trusting their judgment, right? I mean, you give them the knife, then they do something. You don't know if it's good or not. So you're not just trusting, like, oh, I did it, and now they'll check it. You're really trusting they did it carefully. They'll tell you if they did it wrong. There might be economic reasons for them to be sloppy about it. And yet, you're trusting their judgment on all sorts of religious... They have to make religious judgments that this, you know, that certain things have been done properly.
Okay, and this is a person who apparently in other religious matters has said this. And let me just sort of like sharpen this further based on what we saw last time. For those who were here last time, you may recall. Yeah, you want to jump in?
Just a question.
Let me just finish this thought, and then we'll go to the question. One of the things we saw last time was, oh, if you're suspect with regard to a biblical law, for sure you're suspect with regard to a rabbinic law, right? Being suspect with regard to circumcision is not a garden variety biblical prohibition. It actually has karet attached to it. It has the notion of being cut off from the Jewish people. It's one of the most serious things that a person could violate. How can you take someone who's at that level of sort of throwing out a fundamental, at least when measured by the consequences, and now suddenly trust them with something that it would seem is, okay, it's not allowed to eat improperly slaughtered meat, but it's just on the level of don't do that, biblically, not on the level of if you do this, you're out, right? That's part of what's surprising. And we're going to come back and see how that plays out.
So what we seem to be discussing here is a case where somebody is deviant in one set of practices, but you're asking them to do a different active practice altogether that may not, isn't obviously connected with the first practice. But it's all deals with formal actions, you know, like physical formal actions. How does this also, does this also carry through to religious activities? So if you know somebody eats pork on Yom Kippur or something like that, could he still be, or he or she still be a shaliach tzibur, because you know that they're, you know, when they daven, their kavanah is clearly there. Is there a...
Okay, so good. When we get now to our first category, you'll see, we're not going to answer that, I mean, we can talk about that question. The sources won't directly answer that, but they are going to grapple exactly with what you're feeling your way towards, which is there a coherent way of thinking about different realms of, you know, in this case, let's say Jewish practice and Jewish life, but again, with the broader lens I'm trying to put on this discussion, is there a way of segmenting our relationship of trust with people around different areas, right? Just to take it for a second to like the denominational space in American Jewish history, this has been one of the big debates. Does the fact that I look at someone else and see them either as like a complete heretic throwing out the Jewish tradition, or like a rank misogynist, right? Whatever it is, pick your favorite insults that you like to hurl at people in other camps, okay? Does that mean I can't sit on a communal board with them around Israel or communal tzedakah, right? That has been a not simple question, precisely as a reflection of this. How much can I cabin things off, or how much, the second someone, you know, denies or completely misses a fundamental of interpretation of the Torah in my eyes, do they almost just become, not because I think they're going to lie to me, per se, but the whole priority structure is off in a way that I can't build anything, or part of what's tantalizing about this text, it seems to be okay with the notion that someone would reject circumcision and you're still eating the meat that they're slaughtering. Right? The question will be how, as I said, this is sort of the close of last time, how does this sit aside the other things we saw that seem like they say, oh, someone violates a biblical, you know, they don't care about the rabbinic, and all sorts of other components there. Yeah, Chelsea.
It seems like the language, but it's in opposition to Rava's point in that someone who does something because they desire it will let it slide, but saying they won't be circumcised is specifically done to make a point.
Yes. So first of all, there's maybe some ambiguity around how mumar is being used there around the arelut. But yes, in fairness, I'm in the interest of time not taking us through the end of this text, or what the Talmud actually really wants to do is use mumar la arelut in this text, this apostate about the specific abandonment of circumcision, and then say that if you recall, there was a later term in the text that just talked about a Yisrael mumar, a Yisrael who abandoned things. And to say, oh, that must refer specifically to someone who has abandoned the practice of kosher meat, and nonetheless they're allowed to slaughter, and they try to support Rava from that last thing. So it's not, I'm happy to talk about it after, it's not that the case of the uncircumcised person is a perfect match for Rava, it's part of building a case for supporting him, but the main kernel to take out here is the Talmud seems to have no problem blowing past the text that says, yeah, of course someone who like doesn't circumcise themselves is nonetheless valid to slaughter. We could then dig down, what if they're like really totally rejecting X, Y, and Z thing in a dramatic public way as opposed to just saying, I'm not doing that. Maybe there's some give there. But we don't, apparently, according to this text, immediately jump from the more serious prohibition to the less serious one. And that's just a piece to anchor where we go from here. Do you want to...
Just quickly, all of these talks of these texts are making distinctions between ritual acts, very serious ritual acts. So when you were giving examples about sitting on a board with somebody who has very different opinions, I don't see how you could make that jump very easily.
Yeah, so it's not a direct application. I think what I'm going to suggest to you is...
It's not just one moment. It'd be a lot easier to accept that.
For sure.
The ritual act.
That's right. But I think when you see there that people are nervous about doing it there... You can understand some of the dynamics come from some of the same place here. But I'm more illustrating it as a way of how these sort of play out, but not that it's what you hold in this text predicts what you do with sitting on a board.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I was going to strengthen your point around Onish Karev. It symbolically sort of flies in the face of the Chol Arelo Yochal Bo. Like he can't even participate in the ultimate korban, but here you can shech. Like, wow, that's
right. It's very surprising. Very surprising. So we have to figure out what's going on here. All right, so now, leave that, and now we're going to start to work with these three little sub-conversation topics that I want to draw out some ways of trying to make some sense with this. So the first section is going to play with the notion of, well, how do we deal with hierarchies? Are there simple hierarchies? Can you simply look at some, you know, can you make a ranking, basically, from most severe to less severe, least severe, of all the prohibitions, principles. And again, we're doing this in the context of ritual law. You could do it in the context of sort of your assumptions of the worst and most heinous crimes in Jewish and communal life. And can you say, okay, basically, anyone who violates anything on that list, they are untrustworthy and sort of cut off from me and not in my coalition from there down. You know, can you simply just make that list and carry it through? And here we're going to see some fascinating ways of complicating that. So let's start with the Rosh. Someone want to read the Rosh Bechorot 5:8. Start us off one perspective here. Please.
Okay. When we speak of more severe and less severe, we do not mean that one is a violation of a negative commandment and that one is only an implicit failure to affirm a positive commandment. Rather, that one is socially treated more severely and people are careful about it, whereas the other prohibition they are not careful about. In that sort of case, we assume that a person that is suspect in the more severe category is suspect with respect to the less severe category. It is not about the intrinsic greater or lesser severity of the violation.
Okay, so this is one really interesting thing. You may remember, those of you who were here last time, we got a window into this where it was described that in Rabbi Yehuda's community, the sabbatical laws were particularly severely and strictly observed, such that people who did not follow them could be called out and mocked and shamed for not doing so. That's the kernel of an idea here that the Rosh starts to play out, which is, even if we kind of have some ranking of one debate, one place of mistrust leads me to another place, there's two ways of thinking about that. One is from some theoretical internal set of metrics that have to do, let's say, with the severity of the punishment associated with them in biblical and rabbinic law. But the other way of thinking about it, which he says is the way you have to think about it, is it's actually just a mirror held up to how the society deals with it. In other words, there may be contexts where, indeed, it is considered a much more serious thing to eat non-kosher meat than to be uncircumcised. You could imagine such a context, says the Rosh, and even though in a sort of dry biblical zone it's quite obvious which is higher, you actually have to look at the social context. Now, what I think is like fascinating and actually very useful about this text is this is also a way of the Rosh saying that this whole question of trust and feeling like I'm on the same team with this person is actually not about some like theoretical debate that we're having. It's actually about how is this person fitting in to the society that we live in. It is a fair assumption, says the Rosh, that if someone is willing to flout certain norms that are taken quite seriously in the community, they will be willing to flout all sorts of other things, right? And then that, of course, opens up the much trickier question of, well, what happens when those things shift in a given society, right? We live today, and this, by the way, has nothing to do with the normative judgment about whether something is okay or not. It's just observing how do people treat things, right? We gave last time the example of how many people who might eat non-kosher meat or might have any number of things of practices around various biblical commandments that they don't particularly consider those boundaries to be important, might be incredibly meticulous in observing the laws of mourning when, God forbid, their parent dies, right? And that reflects a certain sense, not really of like what is intrinsically more important on a like punishment or consequence scale. There's some mix of you know, a sense of how much a mitzvah or a practice actually speaks to me and gives me emotional meaning. And there's also often a sense of, well, people are really expecting this of me. Like, on that, they don't judge me. But this is something, like, you don't not do X, right? And the Rosh is trying to actually capture that in some way here. Yeah.
So just a further clarification, is he saying that, is the Rosh saying that you really can't order violations of commandments without taking into account the social context?
Yeah. That is correct. That is correct. And by the way, you should know, this gets ruled in the Shulchan Aruch. This actually becomes an established principle, with the one exception, it seems, but the one exception that seems accepted this way, is the public violation of Shabbat. Which is why, by the way, if you follow the things around like kashrut and who can get a certification and not, the reason that the Shabbat factor gets so inflated around those questions of, well, the restaurant's open on Shabbat or this or that, which seems to have nothing to do with kashrut, is because there is this one area of public Shabbat violation which certainly pre-modernity was understood to be a very public statement of telling the Jewish community to take a hike. And even though, of course, that is no longer transparently the case at all in modern Jewish life, that vestige of that norm doesn't die so easily. But in principle, just so we understand, in principle, someone who, according to like the Shulchan Aruch, someone who smoked on Shabbat, but would never do it in front of a group of 10 people, but they would do it in front of 2-3 people, like it's not totally hidden. They won't do it in a public space. Okay? Or there's things that they do, but oh my God, they would never, as soon as they're like anywhere near the synagogue, they won't do those things. That person's Shabbat observance or lack thereof has no bearing on their trustworthiness on kashrut in a context where society or the context values that or has more boundaries around them. And that's a direct result of this. Okay? So again, part of it, going back to my introductory comments, part of what I like and find intriguing about this text is it's sort of reminding us there's a dimension here that is very much about the social relationships and what's the meaning of this action in the group of people in which I live. Okay? Let's push to the next two things here, which will give us a fuller picture of this model, and then we can comment on that and then move to another. Okay, the Rashba. The Rashba says the following. I'll read this, and then I'm going to ask for a volunteer on the Beit Yosef. The Rashba is responding to someone, and he says as follows. With respect to what you said, that someone suspect with regard to a light prohibition is suspect with regard to a more severe one. Someone came to him and seemed to have a picture of, once someone's not following Jewish law, all bets are off. Okay? This, as we saw, was out of sync with the Talmudic passage we saw last week, which did seem to say, well, a more severe prohibition, being cavalier with a more severe prohibition implies you'll be cavalier with a less severe one. But no one really ever said the opposite, but you can get the mentality here. Someone's saying, well, what I do is I look out, and I basically say, does the person care about the things that I care about? The second I find that they totally don't care about something I care about, I can assume there's no synchronicity between us at all. The Rashba says in response to that, not only are you wrong on that, he's not even suspect with regard to a less severe prohibition. One who is deviant with respect to circumcision is not presumed to be deviant with respect to slaughter. Quotes the text that we began with and says, that's proof that we don't play that game at all. Nonetheless, with respect to the area in which he's suspect, he's considered completely deviant. Yeah, if you know someone eats non-kosher meat, you can't trust them about whether certain meat is kosher or not. But if you know that someone doesn't circumcise themselves, I don't care how serious that prohibition is, it has nothing to do with any other area in Jewish law. Now, for those who were here last week, you should be asking yourself, oh my God, how does the Rashba completely ignore the Mishnah in Bechorot that we saw, the Sugya on it, which seemed to very clearly say there's some kind of hierarchy? This is the Beit Yosef's response, and here we'll get another way of engaging this. So this is on the bottom of 2 in the Hebrew and on the top of 3. Can someone take this one voice Rabbi Yosef Karo for us.
That which Rashba wrote, that a person suspected of deviancy in one area is not suspected of areas of lesser severity, is difficult to make. The Mishnah teaches that one who is suspect, either with regard to Shemitah produce or with respect to tithes, is suspect with regard to purities. And the Talmud explains that this is because once he is suspect with regard to biblical prohibitions, he is suspect with regard to rabbinic ones.
Okay, question should be pretty clear. The Talmud says there was a priority list, there was a hierarchy. How can the Rashba deny there being any ability to judge from one category to another? Okay, go on.
Perhaps one can say that the Rashba's position only applies in a case of two different types of prohibitions, as is the case with regard to the proof he brought from the fact that the deviance with respect to circumcision does not imply deviance with respect to slaughter, which is less severe, because there are two different types of prohibitions. But Shemitah produce and tithes and purities, even though they are separate prohibitions, they are nonetheless all centered around food and are therefore considered one prohibition for these purposes. Therefore, one who is suspect with respect to a severe prohibition around food is suspect with respect to a less severe one around food. This seems right to me.
Okay, this is a really interesting different axis, right? Just to be clear here, now we're not talking about what's the, like, peer reinforcement or the social boundaries around this. That was the Rosh's contribution to our discussion. Here the Beit Yosef is doing something different. It's almost more of a kind of like anthropological lens from the perspective of what kind of action are we talking about? And here, Michael, we're starting to go a little bit into your question of, are there different realms? Says the Beit Yosef, and this is a sort of brilliant example of, right, we had like the eight different building blocks from the Talmud, basically from last time, which don't all synthesize, right? Like, you can't really take the hierarchy texts in Bechorot and make them a perfect match for the uncircumcised slaughterer in Chulin. So everyone's going to be essentially picking a winner and a loser and molding the losing text to fit the mold of the winning text. And that's what the Beit Yosef does here, which is essentially to say, you know, I do have this text that talks about hierarchies, and it seems like it's crossing categories. But if I think about it, even though it's totally different categories of law, it's not different categories of human experience. The human experience of tithes and Shemitah produce and purities is all the human experience of what do I eat or not. There, in the world of eating, I can reasonably say, well, if someone's willing to eat something that carries a more severe prohibition, right, then I can assume they'll do something less, okay? By the way, just to give you an example, and this even breaks out of the food categories. Some have heard me, it's one of my favorite examples that I learned years ago where one thing can sort of stand in for abandoning a whole host of things. In Visigothic Spain, when they are trying over and over and over to convert the Jews, and they, like, convert them. They're like, we converted all of them. But then you see there's, like, more edicts, you know, a couple generations later. So it clearly didn't all work out. One of the things they're trying to do is, how can we get the Jews to very clearly and publicly renounce their Judaism? And it reaches a point where the requirement for a Jew and a Christian to have a Jew, by the way, right, who's already converted, but is still known as a Jew, a Jew and a Christian, if they want to have a binding contract that can be enforced in court, it must be sealed in Visigothic law while consuming a dish of pork. Okay? Now, that's an amazing statement about, first of all, the taboo and the sort of duration of pig, right, in Jewish life. But it is also a recognition that I don't need to get them to do all 613 commandments in reverse. There are some that can stand in for the rest. If I can break them on this, right, in other times in Jewish history, that's been idolatry, and parts of the Hanukkah story and other things reflect that. Circumcision has also been at times that, but that's more of not doing something as opposed to an act of violation, right? That's a great example where it sort of carries out even beyond food. But it captures the notion that the Beit Yosef is making more minorly here, which is, let's face it, food is kind of, as much as we may conceive of it in rabbinic legal terms, as, oh, there's like 20 different prohibitions here, From the perspective of the human being, there's kind of like, do I take seriously stuff I eat or not? And there it's reasonable to assume there's some kind of hierarchy. But you can't, says the Beit Yosef, to explain the Rashba, extrapolate from the way someone relates to food to the way they relate to some whole other area of life. That could be prayer, that could be circumcision, that could be controlling for the public peace, Shabbat observance. These things speak to different parts of kind of human behavior and human condition, and therefore the Bechorot text that talks about hierarchies should be understood as actually operating in the very limited space of one united field of human experience. But once you're talking about judging how a person will behave in totally different areas of life, yeah, you can't assume that the laws of mourning are somehow affected for someone by the way they relate to Jewish food laws. Those are actually two different, completely different areas. And here, too, I think you see the Beit Yosef reviving some notion of the ability to see in someone simultaneously a person who completely rejects something that is important and central to you, and nonetheless to assert, that really doesn't tell me anything about this other area where we actually may have common ground. That's what this text is contributing. Yeah.
Do you buy the Beit Yosef's category that's all about food? That Meiser is about food and not about, you know, and purities isn't about Hekdesh and the Beit HaMikdash? I mean, do you...
Right, so I don't think it's the plain sense of the Talmudic passage in Bechorot. In other words, if you ask me, like, just historically, I would say to you, you have in those two passages actually two conflicting systems for thinking about whether I do or don't extrapolate from one realm to another. And quite frankly,
I'm questioning whether it's even one realm. I don't think it's Shemitah, which has got to do with, you know, Kodesh La'av Haaretz and Maisa, which is about...
Agreed.
I mean, that's not food at all. The food might be the mechanism that it lives out on, but...
I agree with you that if you were just asking me about the Talmudic passage in Bechorot, which that piece is coming out of, when the Talmud says you can extrapolate from a biblical to a rabbinic, I think they think that's across all categories, because I think they would have thought of these as different categories. They happen to have these categories there, but it's not because there's something in common there. The problem is you have this other statement in Chulin, which seems to completely reject that whole way of thinking. Now, if you ask me the plain sense of the Rashba that the Beit Yosef is making sense of here, I actually think it seems like the Rashba just rejects the sugya in Bechorot and basically says, what I learned from the Talmud in Chulin, where I also have a named sage that's being backed up and I have a Baraita, a clear Tanaitic text that's saying this, that's the controlling text, and it tells me you don't judge at all from one category to another. The Beit Yosef is trying to make shalom between the Rashba and the text in Bechorot. I think, like all resolutions like this, you get two things out of it. One, you get something that's a little conceptually messy, because it's trying to create a kind of hybrid of two things that weren't really in dialogue. But you also get a kind of powerful manifestation of what it looks like for two value systems to somewhat messily coexist. And here, what he's trying to hold together is, on the one hand, different areas of life should be judged differently. People should be, essentially, we should take compartmentalization seriously, right? That's like the piece that's like two different areas. And we should take seriously that when we have hierarchies or scarier and less scarier ways of talking about things, that also presumably infiltrates human consciousness. And here, the balance is tipped towards compartmentalization, with saying you could compartmentalize across categories. Within categories, the rhetoric that we use will influence. But it is a little messy, because it's kind of a hybrid of two things. Yeah?
It's confusing to me that they're taking the Chulin writer to mean that we should be compartmentalizing, when they explicitly say that you have to check the knife. That tells me that they actually don't trust an Aral or anything else, or anyone else on Chulin. And the only reason that they're saying that he can do it is because they basically made it so that he doesn't really need, or doesn't derive any benefit from ignoring the law.
No, but remember, checking the knife does get you to not rely on them for the knife. But you are not checking whether they are then doing the procedure correctly with the knife. Are they applying pressure with hagrama? Are they doing other things that will invalidate the shechita?
But that's essentially like not particularly like complex a task. Like everything that could go wrong, other than they get distracted and stop sawing for a moment, like could be checked or is part or to do with the knife.
I don't think that's accurate. In other words, I agree with you, it has eliminated one major source of concern, but someone who was deliberately careless about shechita, even with a perfect knife, could do plenty of damage. And that's certainly the assumption of the Gemara, because the Gemara, in a piece we skipped over, says, well, once you trust him to slaughter the animal, why don't you also trust him for the knife? To which their response is, well, the knife is too much of a pain in the neck to get right. Now, that affirms what you're saying, which is, yeah, we're more worried about the knife, right, than we are about the other piece. But it's also very clear, we're very confident he could screw up in that area. It's just we feel like it takes minimal effort not to screw up. And since we don't assume he has bad intentions, we assume he'll do that. But this is always the case when we're dealing with these relational things. The question only arises when we're dealing with someone, right? If you're encountering someone in these areas of ritual law or in other areas where you feel like the person has bad intentions and they're out to get you, of course you're not going to even sit down. The question is, how do you interact with someone where you feel like they have good intentions, but they're like a really wrong, well-intentioned person that is willing to make all kinds of conscious choices that you think are an error? How much does the good intention go there? Bring you to that place. So I just think there's still a place for him to screw it up.
But the Gemara really doesn't care about that, because it also says that if a guy walks in, does the shechita, and then runs away, you can trust he did it correctly. So like.
But therefore, what do you mean? Why does that mean they don't care about it?
It just seems to me that the Gemara really isn't worried about people doing the shechita wrong.
I would put it this way. They are not worried about it at a level. Essentially, once they can eliminate malice, they are not overly worried about it. That is correct. But that is itself wrapped up in some notion that the person is well-intentioned and there's no reason to assume they're going to mess it up. Not that it's impossible for them to mess it up. And that's just the distinction I think we have to hold. Yeah.
I think in terms of like trustability, and like the technology of surveillance that we have nowadays, and also like the economy of surplus, we can afford to not trust people, as we see in Israel in terms of moving there and not being obviously Jewish, right? And we can turn people away in a way that we haven't been able to do for thousands of years in Jewish history. Thank God. I'm gonna bring in an example that might be a little bit controversial, but I think it actually like expands this idea. I think this narrative that we have that's like going from the Rosh through the Beit Yosef, namely that Torah is not like an objective fact book, or like it's just a rules book, and it's like objectively the case it is, but it's a Torah claim, it's a Torah of life, and it's really it's a way of living out certain set of norms that are weighted according to different communal or personal standards, and those standards and that weighting actually has real religious significance. A common kind of pushback to the hyper-emphasis on sexual deviancy in certain forms of right-wing religiosity. A common pushback on that is, it's just one commandment that they're breaking. You know, do you care so much if they eat shrimp? Or in the Jewish community, would you you call people up and break Shabbos all the time and give them an aliyah? Why are you da-da-da? Now, I don't agree with the logic that gives overemphasis to caring about what is termed, you know, sexual deviancy. But I think it's really important that if actually persons who are passionately in defense of an expansive community that includes queer Jews, it's really important to actually understand where people who are coming from are bringing their logic so that you can actually actively respond to it. And that requires an understanding like that Torah is not an objective rule book with just equally weighted norms. But for them, for whatever reason, and it's worth figuring out why, there's a special emphasis on this one in terms of organizing a community. And if you want to try to change that, if you want to try to have a real dialogue and push towards more inclusion, it means actually really understanding what their Torah of life is about, and not to assume that they're being just irrational.
Yeah, so it's a good example, which we could, you know, you can play from the other end as well. I think the question of the integration of same-sex relationships into religious Jewish life is also an example where on the other side you see, what does it look like for various communities to hold constant the notion of, well, I'm not sure I can permit this, and the Torah says this is an offense punishable by stoning, etc., etc. And yet, in the context of the Rosh, to watch that become not an object of focal, central concern, as opposed to all sorts of other things. Meaning we've seen, right, in a way that would not have been true 100 years ago, there are now, in fact, many communities where, yes, they might even say, I'm not sure that's allowed. But it's much more important whether people are observing Yom Tov than whether I think they're exactly conforming to my understanding of what the Torah forbids around sexuality. That's a perfect example of the Rosh's statement of, once something has shifted socially there, even if in some absolute sense you haven't moved in terms of the Torah's internal rhetoric, it has a completely different meaning what it then means to live in that community. So on both sides, I think that's 100% true. Okay, good. Let's take that piece. That's sort of piece one of the conversation I wanted to introduce, what it looks like to refocus some of those hierarchy things on their meaning in the community and to take seriously the notion of compartmentalization and the kind of different experiences of different interactions with mitzvot. Let's now move to another piece, which is what I'm calling here the gift economy and human nature. And here we're going to revisit the text, I'll remind you, that we had last time. I should have reprinted it here, but I didn't. I'll say it out orally again. We had a text last time that said, there are all these things that are, you know, various things produced by Gentiles, the cheese, milk, various things, that the Mishnah says you're not supposed to buy from Gentiles, okay? And then a later text says, any of those products you cannot buy from Jewish shopkeepers in Syria, right? Again, these people on the borderlands as you're heading out of Eretz Yisrael. And the presumption seems to be that a lot of the things that are stocked in their store and that they will sell to you as a Jewish customer are the Gentile versions of these items that the Mishnah forbids. So you can only buy from them if they have basically some kind of certification. Okay? But then the Talmud said, but if you're hosted in their house, you can eat it. Okay? And furthermore, if they send you a gift, you can eat it. All right? And there were two kind of explanations there. When they're hosted in their when you're hosted in their house, they can eat it. When they send it to you, you can eat it. Why? Well, first of all, we don't presume that the owner abandons the permitted versions of these food and eats the forbidden versions of them. And when someone sends you a gift, presumably they send you from the stock of things that they eat. Right? Those were two cryptic statements. If you're not quite clear what they mean, neither were the G'dolei HaRishonim, the great authorities that we'll see in a minute. All right? But that was the base text. And the question we tried to sort out, which was not clear from the text itself, and what we're going to jump into now, is what are these people doing? Are they themselves eating the non-kosher versions of these things, but then somehow you're trusting them nonetheless? And if so, what is that about? Or would they never eat those things, but they are willing to sell them to you, but they would never serve them in their house? In which case, what's that about? Okay? Trying to put together, what's the actual pattern of behavior, first of all? Just a factual question. What is happening with these shopkeepers and their guests? What is their own personal practice? And then what do we learn from that extrapolating out to, you know, what kind of paradigm this serves as for relationships more broadly?
Did you last time speak about the possibility that even if they were not, they were eating that stuff themselves, that they would take you into mind and that was in respect for you, and therefore they would not give you a non-kosher questionable product?
So this is what we're going to get into right now. I threw that out. That's one way of thinking of it. But I'm going back to our sort of tabula rasa of we have this odd case, and we got to figure out what it is. Okay? So actually, why don't you read us Rashi? Rashi's going to set up one reading of this. And actually, you can read Rashi followed by the Torah Tabayit by the same Rashba we were just reading earlier.
One does not buy the following products. That's a quotation. The shopkeepers in Syria are suspect because they are not careful about, quote, not placing a stumbling block before the blind, with me here, and they sell Jews things that they have purchased from Gentiles, but they do not eat these forbidden items themselves. Therefore, if one is hosted in their home, it is permitted to eat them, to eat with them.
Okay, read us the Rashba also. We'll take these as a pair, because Rashba really builds on Rashi's interpretation.
What did you learn from the completed
passage which we have been discussing? A law about one who is suspect to eat Gentile cheese. It is permitted to give such a person cheese to cook with, because we do not suspect the person switching what was provided. But if you say, make me a dish with cheese, one must worry that it has been made with Gentile cheese. If the person is only suspect to sell Gentile cheese to the public, then one may not buy from him. One may not buy from him, but if one is hosted by him or received a gift from him at one's home, then it is permitted to eat, for the person will only serve or send as a good gift the food that he eats himself.
Okay, it's a little bit complex, but we're going to make it clear and simple. Rashi says about this case, what's going on? Do these people eat the non-kosher food themselves, these shopkeepers in Syria? They do not. They do not. Okay? What happens? They have the stuff they sell in their store. And there it's a free-for-all. They sell to anyone who comes in, Jew, Gentile, whatever it is, and they sell them including things that Jews are not supposed to eat under rabbinic law. And that's what happens in their store. But then at home, they're like frum rabbinic Jews who follow all the laws, and there's nothing problematic. They have a totally kosher house. Okay? That's Rashi's picture here. So how do I understand why I'm not allowed to buy from this person who's scrupulous about observance and kashrut in their house? Because they apparently in their store lack any notion of lifnei iver lo titein michshol. They lack the notion that part of their religious obligation is to make sure that other people are not violating religious laws on their account. Therefore, they have no problem. They're basically like, it's your problem to figure out what you're buying in the store. I'm not policing that for you. Okay? I don't care about that. And that's why you can't trust in the store. But otherwise, you can eat in their house. Okay, now, just to sort of understand what this is saying and how it makes perfect sense. On a basic economic model, this is perfect. I mean, this is the way you would think you would operate, which is to say, look, I keep kosher. I got to make a living. This is what you suggested when we talked about this. I got to make a living for all kinds of reasons that may also have to do with the culture of the store and not checking who everyone is, and I don't know, and it's too much work. It's not like I'm going to go to a random Jewish person and try to get them to eat something that's non-kosher, but I am not worried. Everyone's going to have to police themselves in my store. I'm not going to worry about that. And quite frankly, even if someone who comes, who's Jewish, who says, I want to buy this, I'm not going to start messing with my orders and my profit margins and this and that to say, I can't sell you this. I have to wait till tomorrow. I just sell. Okay? We can totally understand how that happens. Rashi points out that is a failure on some level of upholding the law of lifnei iver, of not putting a stumbling block before the blind. But that does not compromise their trust in their own home, which is a different realm where we know they're trustworthy. Now, by the way, parenthetically, this is not Rashi's point, but you see here at work an assumption that someone who violates the biblical commandment of not placing a stumbling block before the blind is not suspect with regard to even the rabbinic commandment not to eat Gentile cheese. Right, so there, even though it's like the Beit Yosef seems to have been right about the way this plays out, these are understood to be two different realms. Right, and this either does or does not bode well, depending on your perspective, for something that came up in some of the earlier sessions. If I find out that someone is like a total thief, does that tell me anything about their kashrut observance? Right, and the answer would seem to be, according to this model, no. Right? That also matches a lot of experience.
Yeah,
right? Like, it doesn't, and in part that goes to the compartmentalization, but here we have a different kind of compartmentalization. It's very important to me that my home is glatt kosher. What I'm an agent for going on in my store, that's another story. Right? We're not talking about someone dishonest here, but we are talking about someone who does not have that kind of vicarious responsibility in public. Yeah?
Would the Beit Yosef really see these as two different areas? I mean, wouldn't he say it's both not food?
It's food. You could say it's the mm-hmm. subcomponent of lifnei iver, of not leading someone astray. It's about food. Good. Okay, so you could say. But the problem is, but then it would melt down. right? Meaning he wouldn't want to say that, because then Rashi would be departing from his theory. You can imagine someone trying to, but it works better here if you say not, because then it makes it more coherent. Yeah.
And would it matter if you go into the store and you ask the shopkeeper directly, you point to the Kraft American cheese over here, and you say, is this stuff really kosher? And, you know, it's one thing to just walk into the store and let the buyer beware.
Right.
Is it another thing if you actually go up to the owner of the store and say, you know, Irving, is this stuff really kosher? Can he just lie to you? Or?
Okay, so from here we don't know enough. Okay, we'll go to the, by Rav Moshe Feinstein at the end, you'll have another perspective on that. From this, we don't know enough to answer that question, all right? And that's what Rashi, all Rashi we know has said is, here's the picture of what's happening. Person would never eat it on their own, but in their store, they're willing to play a little fast and loose. Yeah.
Is there a reason why the shopkeepers in Syria are singled out?
Well, so it seems, I think there's a lot of reasons. On some level, it's descriptively true, apparently. In other words, that they sometimes sell those things. If you then want to ask why was that so, I think it has to do with them being on the borderlands. In other words, you're already in a zone where there's more of a market for Gentile cheese because there's Gentiles there, right? And all sorts of things that already make you're not in a fully Jewish zone in the same way. We could speculate all the factors that lead to that, but the most basic thing is they are in a more mixed population than people that are more in the heart. Not that Eretz Yisrael is so pure and full of Jews, but there's more of a sense of being in the kind of concentrated heart.
Does this apply to all mixed populations then?
So it might. Well, this is why Syria, I think, this I want to affirm implicitly in what you're saying. There's nothing magical about Syria. Syria is just the zone where this is going on, and this would apply, we'll see, people in 13th century Spain are keenly interested in this question, even though they live very far from Syria. Because the point is, what kind of model does this set up? All right, so geography is just sort of a happenstance detail that we get from the Talmudic period. But what does it teach us about the dynamics? All right, now let me just say one more word here. That's what Rashi says. But I want to be clear about what Rashi is implying. And that's what the Rashba draws out. By Rashi insisting that these people would never eat the non-kosher food in their home, he is implicitly saying, if they did, of course you could never eat in their home. In other words, he's partially clarifying. He's saying, I want to be very clear here. When the Talmud says these shopkeepers who are very happy to give Jews this forbidden food, right? When we say that, and then we say you can be hosted in their house, we're only saying that because their house is a totally kosher zone. If their behavior in the store is indicative of their own personal carelessness around what kind of cheese they eat, well then, forget it. The Talmud was never talking about that. That's what the Rashba here codifies. He says, right, starts off in saying, someone who suspects a Gentile cheese, sure, if you give them a block of kosher cheese, you don't have to worry that while you're not looking, they're going to switch it with something else. But in general, someone who doesn't observe that boundary, you can't assume that they're serving you something. When you just say, hey, can you make me a lasagna? That they're going to use cheese that's acceptable to you. That is only the case, says the Rashba, if the only place you suspect them is in their business. If they're selling the stuff, that doesn't mean they would serve it. Right, but the implication is, of course, if they would serve it, they would serve it to you. Okay? Now, this now invites an amazing reflection by the Ra'ah, Rav Aharon Halevi and Berek HaBayit, who totally takes down the Rashba and completely rereads the entire Talmudic passage with a dramatically different understanding of the human nature elements that are going on here. All right, so someone want to take this? It's a little longer, but it's a good one.
What Rashba said is wrong, because in Syria, anyone who is not certified is suspect to eat those forbidden foods as well. If you say that they are only suspect to feed people these forbidden foods, but not to eat them themselves, there is no example of such a person who is presumed to be suspect to cause others to sin and to lead them astray while looking out for himself, other than Samaritans, who don't hold by the rabbinic interpretation of not placing a stumbling block before the blind. In fact, it is just the opposite. A person is more careful about what he gives to other people. Rather, the people in Surya were suspect on all counts, and nonetheless, it is permitted to eat food that they send as a gift. The Talmud says,
in the passage that we read last week,
the host will not abandon something permitted in order to eat something forbidden. And when he sends him something, he sends him what he himself eats from. This does not refer to what the shopkeeper himself eats. It is merely a parable. Just as we say, generally, that a person does not abandon permitted food in order to eat forbidden food, so too, we say that one who sends a gift to his friend surely does so to honor him. Otherwise, it would be better to send nothing at all. Once he is sending him something, he is surely careful not to invest energy to send something that may not please his friend. Therefore, he sends something he knows his friend will eat. It is better to send nothing rather than to send him something that he won't eat and thereby lose the value of his gift. This is similar to how a person avoids forbidden food when permitted food is available. This must be the right reading. If not, why does it say the host will not abandon something permitted in order to eat something forbidden? How do you know he has permitted food? Moreover, that formulation suggests that when he does not have permitted food available, he indeed eats forbidden food. Maybe at that moment, he only has forbidden food and is sending what he is eating.
Okay, we're going to stop there. The Ra'a goes on with another way of formulating this that we're not going to get into. There's a lot going on here. Let's start from the beginning, okay? The Ra'a starts with actually a fundamental assertion about human nature, which he clearly disagrees with the Rashba about, as we will see in a minute. What's the fundamental claim here? The fundamental claim, remember Rashi came along and said, yeah, the shopkeepers, they don't care about lifnei iver, about other people's stuff, just like the Samaritans, right? As if, yeah, that's a human type. The Ra'a says, that's not a normal human type. When the Ra'a hears the Talmud talking about the Samaritans as people who don't follow the rabbinic interpretation of you're not responsible for anyone else's religious welfare, the Ra'a almost reads that like a cartoon character. It's like a made-up person who is in some crazy category of a kuti, who were these wacky people who behaved, and we talked about this a little bit last time when you're trying to figure out, like, how do they even think? How are they like going through life, you know, making the decisions they make? And the Ra'a similarly doesn't really understand these people. It's like, look, the Talmud tells me that there's these Samaritans who bizarrely are willing to deeply care about religious law when it comes to themselves, but then say to someone else who's observing that same law, yeah, whatever, that's your problem to figure it out. But he says, other than the Samaritans, who the Talmud has like forced us to accept that they are bizarre in that way, no one else would behave that way. And in fact, what does he say? The normal thing is that, we'll debate this in a minute, but let's understand what he's claiming. The normal thing is you care more about other people's principles than your own. You may cut this corner, that corner, that's what you do for yourself, but you know that something's important to someone else, that they're under a religious obligation that you respect. Chas v'chalila that you would do anything to lead them astray. Right? If anything, the vector goes in that direction, says the Rashba. Therefore, don't construct some person with me who does one thing in the store, doesn't give a damn that they're selling Gentile cheese to every Jew who's walking in, but suddenly in their house, they're so frum. No, that must not be the case. In which case, the only way to make sense of this text is, what's the deal with the shopkeepers? Why do they sell Gentile cheese? Because they eat it. Like, they sell it to Jews because they don't care. They eat it in their own house. They eat it all the time. But when they're hosting someone who they know won't eat that kind of cheese, oh my God, they would never serve that. And part of what the Ra'ah uses to back that up is what I called in the title here, right, the subtitle, The Gift Economy. He says, why do people host each other? Why do people do things for each other? They don't do things for each other and host each other in order to trip people up on their principles. They host them and are in relationship with them and make investment of time and energy because they want those people to feel actually indebted to them, subconsciously or consciously, like they've done something nice, or they're repaying a favor, or whatever it is. When you give a gift, you're actually trying to accomplish something. You're not just saying, most of the time, I got this thing sitting in my closet, right? In other words, most gifts, says the Ra'ah, are not re-gifts, right? They're not just about finding a way to offload something and not caring about someone else. You can see the Rashba is lurking at the door and saying, yes, they are. But right? But the Ra'ah is saying, no, think about the function of what's happening here. Actually, the whole point of that interaction is to understand someone, to meet them where they are, and to actually fulfill their needs and obey their principles and their standards even more than you might do when it's just between me. And here's the other thing. One sec. No, it's good. The another way I think you can think about this is a person who says, look, when it's between me and God, I'm not so careful about all these things. But you're bringing in another person and their integrity, that I don't screw around. Right? That's the picture that the Ra'ah is painting on some level, not just of what he thinks is going on in this text, but he's reading this text through that lens on human nature and interactions. Yes, please.
We see it all the time. People bring gifts to your house, or you're having guests over. If they know that you keep kosher, they tend to be careful not to bring a non-kosher thing most of the time. If they don't know, it's ignorance, they will bring you stuff, just be nice about it. So I think he's on to something.
Okay. Anyone else want to either speak to this resonating or begin to offer a challenge? Either way? Yeah, there we go.
I mean, I think it happens a lot, like, in like a Campus Hill, for example. Like, I have friends who, like aren't too much Shabbat, but, like, if I'm around, will, like, be sensitive to that.
Like,
do something. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, people will take care if they know about your standards, but, like, are less likely.
Chelsea, yeah.
Just to play the other side, in our discussion of some of the more nefarious characters, a lot of times people will put a lot of stock in what they imagine to be their relationship with God, but be really dismissive of the needs of other people. And so it could go the other way.
Good. So, and the Rashba is going to come not in that language, but to come and talk about that, right? There's a real, when you formulate it in those kind of stark terms, it starts to make you realize, well, that's based on a very specific set of assumptions. But as I said at the beginning of tonight, I want all the texts that we're learning, I want us to think through this realm of not just what are they saying on the bottom line of what we do here, but actually what are they assuming about relationships? Right? This is making one particular assumption, which both resonates with experience, and we can ask some interrogating questions. Yeah.
There's one other element to it that I think could be a factor in this, that the shopkeeper might not only be concerned about his relationship with God, but also his relationship with the community. I mean, if it's obvious that there's a Jew giving fellow Jews non-kosher food, that might not go over so well with his peers.
Good. So how would you expect that to play out here, then?
You would expect him to factor that in, as well as the fact that maybe he views other people's relationships with God as equally important to his own relationship with God, and would say, you know, therefore I'll go out of my way to make sure I don't gift anything forbidden.
Okay. Good. Yeah. Nah.
Is there an assumption here that everybody knows what's forbidden and not forbidden?
Right. That's right. So I think, let's put it this way. In the context of the Ra'ah's argument here, I think he is assuming the person does know. That is to say, the second you are in a realm of ignorance, well, then you're in another zone. But the assumption here is that there was some kind of communication where I either said something to this person or they know this about me in a clear enough way, that my only question then is, given that they know that information, how are they likely to act? Right? And I basically have two choices on this. One is, well, because they're not so careful about it themselves, they'll say, or I will expect of them and say, so they're not going to care about this because they don't care about the thing. That is to say, when abstracted from our relationship, they don't care about that prohibition. And I might conclude from that, so I can't trust them. The Ra'ah says, no, do not view it that way. Do not abstract it from the relationship. The relationship is the whole thing. Understand that there is no such thing, actually, as caring about a prohibition or not caring about a prohibition. It's what's the context in which I'm engaging with someone. If it's a context where it would be incoherent to assume that the person would be careless because they're inviting me over. They're sending me a gift. They're basically doing something of their own free will, investing time and money for me, says the Ra'ah. There we can assume, provided that they know what your standard is, that they're going to meet that. Ezra, did you?
Yes, I was going to say that I think that it's very difficult to accept some sort of bottom line argument on an issue like this, kind of related to that last one, which is that there are so many different types of people. There are the types of people who are ignorant, the types of people who know the halakha, the types of people we discussed about last week, who think they know what's best, and therefore are going to try to get you to do what they think is best. They might think that something is a sword, and people think that it is a sword. But even within this world where we're discussing a specific type of person who thinks that it's asur, but they're going to do something for themselves and not for other people, perhaps, there are some people who are the types of people who really care about other people, and there are some people who are the types of people who only care about themselves. So it's very hard for me to see it, like us saying, like, we're going to pick the Ra'ah here, we're going to pick the Rashba here. It seems like we're like, you have to, like, for every single person that you know, you have to make the judgment.
Right, so I think there's no, I mean, look, that's for sure my bias with these debates, which is you never really win by saying, oh, these two argued, and now I pick this one or that one as the winner. Any good debate like this, sofalihis kayem, in the sense that they are both clearly alighting on some truth. I want to hear, before we do the full, you know, post-game on them, I want to hear the Rashba's side of it, but yes, suffice it to say, one can imagine, look, the Ra'ah himself says, yeah, there's kutim out there. The Talmud tells me about them. But what I think we can say is the Ra'ah says that your presumption, until you are whacked over the head to the contrary with the Talmud or some fact of life showing you a kuti-like person, that's not the normal default way normal people act. Right? That much, I think, probably people, it's where we'll get, I think, in the end, that much probably people do have a default assumption one way or the other. Whether it's delusional or not is another question, but I think people probably do have some sense of where do I start from, and okay, then I'm going to have evidence that pushes me the other way. Okay, last comment on this, and I want to see the Rashba.
Are there also commentators who take a completely negative position and say, you know, here the default assumption is, in the end, there's some assumption that the person is going to hold to some sort of standard, but is there also some traditional view that says somebody is suspect here, there's suspect all over the place no matter what, and you just run in the other direction without even thinking about it?
Well, the closest we saw with something that extreme was the questioner to the Rashba in the first section, who clearly had suggested that once a person's suspect in one area, forget it, there's nothing. And the Rashba very strongly pushed back and said, that is totally against the way the Talmud talks about this, even going so far as saying you shouldn't jump from one category to another at all. That goes to the question of the notion of a chizkat kashrut. Does someone have a sort of starting default setting, at least as a Jew in rabbinic discourse, of until you know otherwise, you presume that's the case. Now here we get also to a slippery place, which is, how much is that a factual assumption, and how much is that a necessary assumption of the system for a society to function, right? Like, is it correct? Like, there's a default presumption that people are trustworthy because, no, actually people are. Or is it just, you can't live otherwise, right? That's a good and deep question, okay? Let's hear the other side of this. You saw the Ra'ah in part quotes the Talmud and says that thing of why would he abandon permitted food, to choose forbidden food. He understood that to be a figure of speech, meaning this is someone who eats forbidden and permitted food. But just as we said in the Rava case with the slaughtering, why would someone who could slaughter perfectly well and be, you know, producing kosher meat, davka, ruin the slaughter? The Ra'ah sees that as like an expression being used here. Why would a host, you know, just be annoying and serve something that their guest would not think was okay? The same way we say people don't go out of their way to choose forbidden things when they have permitted things. All right, he thought that was a figure of speech of explaining why you can trust. The Rashba then responds. So this is the Mishmeret Abayi, bottom of 5 into 6. He says as follows. How many mistakes did Ra'ah make here? Both with regard to the essence of the matter and the language of the Gemara. Is the author of the Gemara a weaver of parables that he should say things that seem explicit but that are in fact esoteric riddles? What do you mean that's some expression? That's a statement, abandoning permitted and going to forbidden. Clearly there's permitted and forbidden food here somewhere. You have to make sense of it on its own. This doesn't happen anywhere in the Gemara, so he's a bad reader. And he erred with respect to the essence of the matter as well. If he were right, then the people of Surya eat forbidden foods only for their own pleasure, rather than to make a religious point, and we would then be ruling that a person can be hosted by them and eat the food they send. That's, in fact, what the Ra'ah said. But then why shouldn't one be able to be hosted by and receive gifts from one who eats non-kosher meat only for pleasure, and even to eat from his slaughter? That would be unthinkable. The Talmud's clear that one can only eat meat from such a person by checking the knife and giving it to him. So here the whole thing melts down. The Rashba goes back to the passage in Chulin and says, yeah, but you only allowed the guy, if you checked the knife, to slaughter. You're clearly not willing to trust this guy vis-a-vis the meat he gives to you based on what he does. How can you do that? By the way, the Ra'ah's answer would be, not necessarily if he's hosting you. Right? Fine. But the Rashba is, right? He said, we don't trust there. How can he say this? Furthermore, even in the much more lenient case of Dmai, which is produce that's only rabbinically forbidden, from which tithes may not have been taken, we don't allow a person to be hosted by one of the unlettered masses who can't be trusted. This is referring to another passage in the Mishnah that talks about this. And when he says, furthermore, that which the Ra'ah said, that a person is more careful not to feed forbidden food to others than to eat it himself, that's shocking. Why would he love his friend more than himself? Amazing, right? In fact, it's just the opposite. The Mishnah says, Rabbi Yehuda says, you can trust the tithing practices of someone who eats in the home of the unlettered masses. Rabbi Yehuda says to the Chachamim, someone eats with an Am Haaretz, someone who can't be trusted to be keeping all the kashrut and purity laws. If you see that he eats in that person's home, you don't then have to suspect his kashrut just because he eats in someone else's house who has questionable stuff. They said to him, the sages said to him, he's not trusted with respect to his own behavior. How can he be trusted with respect to other people? A text that seems to flow exactly in the opposite direction from the Ra'ah. You start, how does a person behave? Then you figure out, do they go further with respect to other people? But no one ever whether they keep that standard with respect to other people. But no one imagines that they go further with other people than they do with themselves. Rather, it must be the people of Surya were not suspect of eating these forbidden foods, only of selling them, and they were not careful about not placing a stumbling block before the blind, going back to Rashi. All right, now what I want to suggest to you is that actually the debate between the Ra'ah and the Rashba is a debate about human nature and community. Right? Everything else just flows. Like there's proof texts and this and that flying around, but the real thing is the default setting. And actually, another element of what runs very deep here is, do you understand people's religious practices to be fundamentally anchored in a calculus that they sort of play out between themselves, the text, and God, and the rhetoric of those prohibitions as they stand independently? Or do you understand the whole thing to be about the embedding of that in some kind of social context? And the Rashba clearly thinks the former, and the Ra'ah thinks the latter. The Rashba also takes a much more jaundiced view of how much people actually stretch themselves to go out to meet other people's principles, and essentially thinks that's just an extension of how much they care about something. Whereas the Ra'ah imagines that actually there's a default element of human relationships that if you want to understand them, that's actually all about people wanting to please other people. And at least in the context where they're investing in them, that totally overwhelms their own internal religious calculus. Right? So this is where I'm not sure how you resolve this debate, never mind the fact that, like, okay, how do you weigh the Rashba against the Ra'ah, and never mind the fact of, like, the sort of facts on the ground. How do you make this kind of judgment around the human relationship piece? And I guess, you know, Ezra, going back to what you said, but I'll take it from a different angle. One of the answers might be, instead of beginning from the perspective of, okay, is the Rashba right or the Ra'ah right, to actually ask yourself, what would society have to look like for the Ra'ah to be right? And what would society have to look like for the Rashba to be right? On some deep level, I actually think there's probably a kind of like educational answer to that question, which is to say there is probably a way to raise and educate and acculturate people to certain ways of behaving that will lead them to potentially prize the integrity and commitments of other people over their own. And there's probably a way of educating people that will lead them to feeling like, I start with dealing with my own thing. What I get to with other people, that's a later issue. Right? Those are actually ways that are probably deeply ingrained when we talk about what are mitzvot about? What are we in this for? What's the purpose? Is this some kind of personal, independent, batting average that I'm keeping up? Or is this actually some kind of tool that is, you know, creating some sort of interaction between people? And I don't mean to make one of those, the way I just said it makes it sound like one of those is great and the other is horrifying. It's a little more balanced than that, right? For those of me who teach some of this material in other contexts, the risk of making everything relational is things can get very imperialistic and policing of other people and their integrity and when they're keeping it up, etc. But there is something, I think, here to be said about it not being right or wrong, but these being actually two very different pictures of human society. Okay, thoughts, comments on this before we close with the Rav Moshe Feinstein piece. Yeah?
Before we go through the educational process that you described, I can see both of them being right or wrong, but the relationship. I can easily see, say, somebody who's very close or siblings making the efforts and the sacrifice towards somebody who's very close to them versus not really caring about cooking kosher for other people that are less close. So they can both live together even within the same human being and not necessarily just because people are different than each other.
Beautiful segue to Rav Moshe Feinstein, who takes this up exactly, which is what I've called in this last section, does trust conquer all, okay? This is a very self-explanatory tshuva. I'm going to ask someone to read it on page 8 in the translation. You volunteering to read?
I was going to just say something in response to that. I think it's definitely true that at some level, like being close to someone or trusting someone could lead to you being more sensitive to their concerns. But I also think that in certain circumstances, the opposite can be true. For example, some guest that I've never met comes over to my house and tells me that they have X and Y eating requirements, or they don't like eat certain foods. I might be very careful to prepare those foods, but that the right foods for them. If my brother says to me, I don't like tomatoes, I'm not going to not make a pasta and tomato sauce for dinner because he doesn't like tomatoes.
Good. Sometimes we know people too well and we're like, I remember you before you cared about any of this garbage. And we take it much less seriously than someone who, right? Right, in that sense, it's like often people who are not Jewish are much better than Jewish people about putting up with whatever variant you have that they think is stupid, right? Because they know too much. Okay, so your penalty for sneaking in the question is to read. That's just a joke. Okay, yeah, go ahead.
When I was in Moscow in 1934, I was asked about the fact that, unfortunately, parents in this country must eat at the homes of their children. who eat all manner of non-kosher food, and most of them deny God and God's Torah, and abandon permitted food in favor of forbidden food. They are therefore not trusted with regard to prohibitions, for the old and weak parents have no other way to eat meat when they need it for their health, nor any other kosher food.
Okay, it's an amazing picture here. It's the elders from the Tsarist regime now dealing with their communist children. Okay? But they're still Jews, and you got people who are still attached to the rules of kashrut, but they are now inextricably dependent on people who have not just that, they're not so careful. They've like embraced an anti-religious line. Okay, so let's see. Oh, I'm sorry, let me just say this for those who weren't here last time and for those who were here, a reminder. Recall one of the texts we saw last time, which didn't appear anywhere in the conversation until this responsive drags it in, was that odd and interesting text of Rav Chista's daughter saying to Rava, who you'll see now, I misspoke last time, I made it sound like it was unclear if they were married. They are married. Rav Chista's daughter is married to Rava, okay? Rava is in a court case, and Rav Chista's daughter says, this guy is a liar. I know he's a liar. And Rava then just decides the court case. Rav Papa comes along with someone else and says, this guy's a liar. And he says, sorry, you're only one witness. And then, you know, someone says, well, what do you mean? Is Rav Papa worse than Rav Chista's daughter? To which Rava says, I'm totally certain about Rav Chista's daughter. I'm not totally certain about you. Okay? Which had some notion of there being some level of trust there with Rav Chista's daughter that allowed a total end run around the normal rules of evidence in a way that was not the case with Rav Papa. Okay, Rav Moshe Feinstein here, it's like one of the biggest moves of Geonut you can imagine, sort of pulls that text out of nowhere and then inserts it right here into our discussion. Right? Brilliance. Genius.
This is the same Moshe Feinstein who ruled so vehemently against the conservative and reform movements.
He has a rich record with many things. We're not taking stock of all of it. But yes, brilliant people generally say a lot of complicated things. I think that's fair to say. Yeah.
I innovated that there was room to be lenient for many people in case where the parent knows and is certain that his daughter or daughter-in-law would not mislead with regard to forbidden food. Because the parent knows this person's character with utter certainty based on multiple experiences, where it was evident that she was not misleading so as not to upset the parent, or because her nature is not to cause other people to violate their principles. The parent can then rely on her and eat what she cooks, even meat items, as long as she says that the meat is kosher and prepared with utensils that were set aside to the parent.
Okay, now here comes the conceptual innovation.
This is not a matter of trustworthiness, but rather solid knowledge, that is, as if one saw it oneself, since it is utterly clear to the parent that she is not lying.
Okay, this distinction is very important. It's a distinction in Rav Moshe between ne'emanut and yidi'ah brura. Ne'emanut, trust, is fundamentally a situation where I am in a black box, and someone tells me that there is something on the other side of the room, and to trust them means, even though I have no way of knowing it, if I trust them, I can then say that thing is on the other side of the room. That is different from someone hands me a pair of binoculars, I look through them, I'm now able to see something very far away that I couldn't see before. But we wouldn't say I'm trusting the binoculars to tell me what's far away. I'm using a tool to actually know that that thing is there in a way that's fundamentally more continuous with my already existing powers of sight than it is with saying I'm relying on another being whose judgment I'm depending on. Rav Moshe wants to claim there are two kinds of human relationships. Many, in fact, most human relationships are built around trust, where fundamentally, you got to rely on the other person. They have the total power to mislead you. But there are other kinds of human relationships where you know the person so well that hearing them say something or them reporting something is just like having a pair of binoculars, where you now know it to be true because either you know their character and they never lie, or you know their tell when they're lying and it's not showing, but you can know it, all right? That's the distinction here. The claim is these parents can't, on the basis of religious law, as we've seen, trust their kids. Their kids eat treif. You can't trust someone who eats treif around treif. He is not going with the Ra'ah, right? He's living in the Rashba's world where that hosting is not going to help him, okay? But, he says, you're not trusting them. You're using what you know about your relationship to know this, all right? Keep going.
The great proof of this is the passage in Ketubot where Rava trusted Rav Kista's daughter. Why was Rav Papa's word less significant than that of Rav Kista's daughter? It must be that, from the perspective of trust, that is to say, when one does not know with clear knowledge that the person is not lying, it is just that the person is righteous and pious and doesn't lie, and therefore one should trust him. There is no basis to trust a single person, because the Torah decreed that even Moshe and Aaron cannot be trusted on their own to decide a monetary case.
You need two. One witness isn't enough.
But this only applies to trust when one does not know the person and their character and traits except by presumption or reputation. But if one knows the person's essence based on their character and behavior, based on multiple experiences, and sees that they do not lie, then this is not a matter of trust, but it is like having seen it oneself. Therefore, even though Rava certainly knew that Rav Papa was a trustworthy person, since he was even more righteous and pious than Rav Kista's daughter, nonetheless, this was just based on his reputation and is therefore in the category of trust. Rav Kista's daughter was different, because I am certain about her, meaning knowledge of her essence, which is not considered trust, but as if he had seen it himself. Therefore, in a pressing circumstance and for weak people, one can be lenient if one knows for sure, based on experience with a person's character and behavior, that they will not lead them astray. One can rely on them and eat what they cook for them
when
they say it is kosher. But others, those not in pressing circumstances and helping people, should be strict.
Okay. It's amazing tshuva, it's an amazing sort of feat of creativity of also taking a text from one area and bringing it in to apply to another. And it captures some of what we've heard, what you just suggested, Yonit, about, you know, there may be different kinds of relationships. And it's trying to say, part of what you also have to know is, what does it even mean, right? You can't even just talk about being in relationship with someone. It's how deep is the communication, how interwoven, right? If that lifnei iver lo titein michshol, the notion of having some vicarious responsibility to someone else, not to lead them astray, is kind of like the floor. But the ceiling that he's painted is where there's almost like a mind meld between the people, where I know you so well and you know me so well in terms of what's important to each other, our concerns become one another. It's not trust anymore. It's I can see and know when you tell me something that it is so. It goes beyond the frontier of relying on you. Yeah.
Are you trusting that? What if this person thinks that they're answering you truthfully, they don't actually know themselves? So how can you, let's say they think they know the laws of kashrut, and so are being 100% honest with you when they say, yes, this food is kosher, but they're wrong.
Good. So this is going back to the question which has resurfaced, which is a fair question, but is not mostly in the contours of the cases here, which is, does ignorance override some of this stuff? And there, obviously, right? There's no question that if the person just actually has no idea, or just cannot be assumed to in any way be following the instructions, then more bets, I don't want to say all bets, but more bets are off, right? But Rav Moshe here is talking about a case where they know how to get kosher meat, they know what it is, they're familiar with it from their parents' house, whatever it is, and they have the level where, yeah, the only way it would get messed up is basically through malice, or to the extent things would get messed up, they would get messed up in the same way that accidents can happen in any kitchen. But the assumption here is there enough holding that they're not going to say, yeah, the meat is kosher, and it turns out they think that all that means is that it's not pig. right? But that has no connection to like how it was slaughtered. A ground assumption here is they know the facts. Second, the facts are not even in order, and then you have bigger problems. But that, of course, is more easily remediable. You can explain to someone the facts, and if you feel they have mastered them, then you'll revert to this question. Can you trust what they're doing with that information? Okay? Yeah, Ezra.
This slightly tangential commentary, what do you think? How do you think this two-language honesty relates to the prohibition of relatives testifying in court against other relatives? And based on formulation you just stated, would that be related to the fact that when a relative says to me in court, I know for a fact that they are right, and therefore I can't testify about it because I would say, because they said it, I know that they're right?
So you don't need Rav Moshe Feinstein. The Rambam, when he codifies that Gemara about the daughter of Rav Chisda, says, look, relatives can't testify in court. They're automatically disqualified. But a judge is empowered to make a decision in a monetary case based on things that he knows are correct. Right? And this is not extended to food or those things, but precisely based on this, the Rambam assumes, well, this shows me that like there is due process and all of that stuff, but the judge is not expected when the judge is not allowed to favor people and allow illegal people to testify and based on their testimony to do that. But if basically by way of them saying something, the judge comes to realize, oh my God, like that clearly happened, then the judge essentially has authority to issue some kind of summary judgment. Now, that may be troubling in terms of the power of the judge, right? Why should the judge, maybe that should be completely disqualified. But assuming that the judge has some power in that regard, it's this dimension of the case where apparently stuff can come in not through the channel of evidence, but some other channel that it would seem, unless you think that's a non-normative case, there is some way in which that comes in. Yeah.
Is there also transitivity here? If you're a judge and you have testimony from a witness who you know implicitly trusts somebody else for the same reason, are you allowed to take their word even though it's like third hand?
So where this comes up here, for instance, is you see at the end here what he hints at is, can others, right? Can others eat in this context? Happened. I somehow lost this page. Right, so the others means people other than the parents. Meaning, what he's emphasizing here is he doesn't think it's transitive that, for instance, the father can then bring his friend over for dinner and say, I trust my kid, right? I know the food's kosher. You come over, right? You might say that would be a transitive application.
Right.
Oh, he's a frum guy.
Right.
He has this way of knowing that this is okay, and then I trust him, so it carries over. There Rav Moshe draws the line, says you can't do that. For acherim, you are not allowed. Now, where this comes out very clearly is in the last tshuva here. We can't do the whole thing, but Rav Moshe is asked, essentially people call him on this, right? The first tshuva is Yoredea, Chelek Aleph, okay? And now we're in the second section of Yoredea. Basically, someone reads the earlier tshuva and is like, well, I have this guy in my neighborhood who has a store that's like, you know, closed on Shabbat, but I know he totally publicly doesn't keep Shabbat, but like he sells meat, and he sells kosher meat and non-kosher meat, but like that guy would never lie. I know him. I totally trust him. And therefore, and even sometimes when I ask him, hey, do you have any kosher meat? He'll say, sorry, I don't have any for you today. Which shows, like, he would not lie to deceive me. And Rav Moshe is asked, so, hey, can we do that thing that we did with the parents, right, with this? All right? And here he says, look at the second paragraph here on the page 9. In order to rely on a person based on the knowledge that they do not lie, one must have clear knowledge. Like a husband who knows his wife, whom he is always around, in a good marriage. Like the case of Rava, who trusted his wife, Rav Chisda's daughter. And like a father and his son, like the case of Rav Papa and his son, Abba Mar. This is based on many things that they have seen continually. And they know that it's not in their character to lie. The but based only on a few experiences, one should assume that there was some reason for the person not to lie in those instances, and perhaps it was even intentional in order to create the presumption that he doesn't lie, so people will rely on him. Once you're in a more distance and business-based relationship, says Rav Moshe, here we see a different kind of jaundiced view of the interactions, there's no thing of just trusting and being on board, okay? And he goes on, I encourage you to read it. Only in the case of a parent and a child or spouses where the knowledge is constant can we say so. And therefore, in this case, he says, there's got to be a mashgiach in that store if you want to be able to trust the kosher meat. There's no way to do it. Now here, too, before we saw the Ra'ah versus the Rashba, here I actually think you see like Rav Moshe against himself. There's almost like an internal machloket here. It's true that the cases in the Gemara are in fact one of a father and son and a husband and his wife. But nothing in the text of the Talmud actually says that that's a limit on the case. It says, Kimli begava, I know with her, right? I have some kind of relationship there. And in principle, it actually seems like that ought to be able to potentially spread out to a whole web of relationships. And there too, I would ask the kind of educational and society building question, what would it look like and what would it take to build a society where a large number of people had relationships, where they felt like hearing that person speak to me is like knowing it myself. That's like the Ra'ah side of Rav Moshe. But then the Rashba side of Rav Moshe starts to get nervous and says, but I see the people are not really that good, and more to the point, part we skipped over, not that consistent. He says people change their character all the time in order to attain certain goals. And once I'm aware of that, how can I suddenly just say, well, this person would never lie to me? And so what you get is this effort to say, I want that principle to exist, but I want it to be very limited. And what I want to suggest to you coming out of Rav Moshe is, whether or not you accept his line, I'm not sure I totally can like accept the bright white line between the spouse and parent child and everything else, but it's an interesting exercise to say, well, where should that line run? Right? And again, this is, I'll say this as the closing word here, and then we'll stop. Happy to stick around a few minutes, and we'll also have Mariv after. This, to me, at the end of the day, kind of summing up so much of what we've seen here, is really I take as an invitation, again, not to just think about what are the technical lines we draw, but really there is something deep here about what are the underlying relationships that set the tone of the conversation. And if you ask me, in my experience also in the Jewish world more broadly, when there is some sense of people actually really being invested in one another and really wanting to care about the things that are important to other people, you actually usually work things out. And by work things out, I don't mean everyone trusts everyone, but you figure out a way to make it happen because actually there's some kind of joint sense. And usually when there is a block where it seems like you cannot resolve something and it seems like people who disagree cannot find a way to come together around that, there is usually at root something that's either in human nature or in the nature of that community where there's actually not a full desire to do so. There's not actually an investment and an agenda in making that possible. And one of the things I want to offer you coming out of this is to think not only about how some of these sources can actually be useful practically for giving us guidance of how to behave and how to interact with others, but to motivate us to have the kind of social fabric that makes some of the more kind of tightly connected and trusting formulations here seem plausible and therefore the right way to live.